Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word, because as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. I mean, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo, because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change comes to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 a piece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She feel like you a motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't. That nigga hurting himself.
You from New State. No.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-WAC movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you gotta own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're gonna have with most of the people around you.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this because it remains the property of the clients. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working. And then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tons of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technician, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Because it's cold, the beer tastes better, and so I get more customers. I'm
by, let me know you hear me. Stay a while, stay with me, as long as you will hear me. Better go straight out and love to hear you laughter. Without a care, you are there, together ever after.
Folks, in this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas, and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat, takes a lot less money to cool, it's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine, or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now, I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively. And you can do this at an age, at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining.
It ain't like stepping on eggs, Jake. Takes a man to kill. You man enough to kill, Jake? Hit me right there. Get me, Jack. Get me. Hit me. Hit me. You can't do it. Somebody drop this fool for me.
You got us twisted, homie. You gotta put your own work in around here.
It's like that, Bone?
It's like that.
Player to player, pimp to pimp. I'm believe you shoot me, nigga. Don't do it. Don't do it. Now I'm believe he got it in you, Jay. I'm going to get that gun, and then I'm going to get that money. And you ain't going to do a damn thing, because you ain't going to shoot no cop in the back, are you?
Don't do it.
You know what they give you for that? The gas chamber. You know what the gas chamber smells like? Pine oil. That's where you headed, boy, to pine oil heaven. I'm going to get that gun, and then I'm going to get that money. I don't believe you got it in you, Jake. I'm going to go get it right now.
Oh! You motherfucker!
The next one will kill you.
Oh, son of a bitch! You shot me in the ass!
Okay, wait. Okay. All right, look. Wait, Jake, I need the money. Give me the money, Jake. Give me the money, please, Jake.
Give me that money!
It's not gonna happen. Oh, you gonna jack me now? You gonna take my own money from me, huh?
I told you, that's my evidence. You wanna go to jail, you wanna go home.
I wanna go home, Jake. Come on, give me the money and let me go home.
Yeah? You want to go home?
Yeah, let me go home, Jake. Come on, give me the money and let me go home. Yeah, give me the money and let me go home. Let me go home, Jake. That's right, come on, Jake. You don't deserve this.
Okay, you motherfucker. Jake, go ahead and bounce on me. Get up out of here. We got your back.
What?
Like that.
Oh, no, you didn't. Wait a minute. No, you did. Hey, Jay! Hey! Jay! 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 Come back here! Jay! You disloyal, fool-ass, bitch-made punk.
Jay! I need my money! J! Oh, you motherfuckers. Okay. All right. I'm putting cases on all you bitches. Huh? You think you can do this shit? Jay! You think you can do this to me? You motherfuckers will be playing basketball in Pelican Bay when I get finished with you. Shoe program, nigga. 23-hour lockdown. I'm the man up in this piece. You'll never see the light of day. Who the fuck you think you fucking with? I'm the police. I run shit here. You just live here. Yeah, that's right. You better walk away. Go and walk away, because I'm going to burn this motherfucker down. King Kong ain't got shit on me. That's all right. Shit. I don't fuck. I'm winning anyway. I'm winning. I'm winning any motherfucking way. I can't lose. Shit, you can shoot me, but you can't kill me.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe. But they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yuba. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yuba builds its own parts on site. So Mr. Huss' supplier is only a bike ride away.
3,000个，赶快送过来。好，这边没有了，已经没有了。是是。
But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock.
因为现在生产线已经停掉了，然后我大概要赶快把它送过去哈。好的。七点钟整装来送料。对对对。
Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day.
好，谢谢谢谢。好。
When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yuba started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year. But Yuba wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down, unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply, and soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Han, and the pressure is on.
那这样的话，那个我先提议再先回去，然后那边先紧急生产，好，然后等一下你就赶快送过去，好，OK，好，谢谢。
Mr. Huh finally arrives, and he has good news.
小叶，小六，这么晚才来。
He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away.
Mom,
I'm back.
His wife, Hong Zhang-Yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly lines. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only two daughters. She's always upset about that. and in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work. And there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at UPA are married to the company. Based in southeast China, UPA is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of UPA and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of UPA's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of UPA jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make UPA more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to UPA in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
UPA management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, UPA could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It would be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin. And Lee needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, we still didn't have much food to eat.
Now, food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasonings that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Xin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job, address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
带他们就像带小孩子一样, 我们用爱,
leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenants' rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
挑战是里面员工有17,000多人，那来自
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low. Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Fu keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. But they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Fu recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of Yupa's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
I think because
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? UFA offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories. A place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle. A company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside UPA's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. UPA's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, UPA has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. UPA's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, UPA must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Ji Rong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is UPA's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future. They returned with a simple message. The future is green.
We studied the consumers of North America and Europe and their thoughts on this new energy of the future. So we know that their love of the earth is actually very strong.
Pan and his designers make a bold decision. The first appliance in UPA's new product line will be powered by the sun. It's a solar CD player.
We want to bring this clean solar energy concept into people's homes.
Going solar may sound easy, but solar panels are expensive, and they're meant to work outside, not in the dim corners of people's homes. A 3D image of UPA's appliance of the future starts to emerge. Now the team must turn a digital design into reality.
This factory is a very important part of our development process. It helps turn a product concept into a finished prototype.
Using the design specs, a computerized milling machine cuts a foam cast. And the cast is converted into a hard plastic prototype. If things go according to plan, the model will be used to produce millions of identical copies.
It allows us to test the product to see if this fulfills our requirements while bringing value to the customers.
Now engineers perfect the solar power system. The system must collect and store solar energy. Every aspect of design must maximize energy efficiency.
We've spent a lot of time studying this. What kind of technology, what kind of material, what kind of parts can help us improve our energy efficiency?
Finally, UPA's product of the future is revealed. The solar CD player is simple and elegant. The player will charge indoors when left near a window. And the system is uniquely versatile. it will work with any energy-efficient appliance Yupa designs. But one question remains. Will the world embrace Chinese solar products?
We want to bring what people originally thought of as an industrial thing and truly integrate it into their daily lives to enable consumers to truly experience solar energy. This is a very magical energy concept.
If these innovative products succeed, Yupa could achieve its dream, a dream it shares with China, to be the factory of the world.
I want consumers and everyone to have faith in our products and faith in the workers. I hope everyone can enjoy the products we produce. This will make us proud.
With Factory City in full swing and new products in the works, more and more goods will carry the Made in China label. But for China and Factory City, growth comes at a cost. Every day, the 17,000 people at Yupa endure the stress and uncertainty of a cutthroat world economy. To fight off fierce competitors and build a better life, these men and women work and live together as one at the factory of the world.
Organizations like the SBA making it easier for you to get into business. But 50 years ago, what do you think the odds would be that you could start your own small business and make it succeed?
The odds were against a black man succeeding in the business world, but John Johnson has never been one to look at the downside. He used $500, perseverance, faith, and family devotion to build an empire worth nearly $200 million. His name is now a legend in the world of publishing, fashion, beauty products, and broadcasting. John Johnson has a formula for taking what seems impossible and making it real. His story is an inspiration for people of all colors.
Well, I guess it just proves in a continuing way that there is opportunity there. That given the knowledge, the devotion, and the sacrifice, that success can come. So it ought to tell us that more young blacks ought to take a chance. I think really that in the past, when young blacks have gone to college, we have assumed that we did not get respect and prestige unless we went into the professions. I think now more and more that is changing. We're recognizing that money and success gives you prestige and recognition, even though it may come from selling hamburgers, it may come from selling barbecue, it may come from opening a grocery store or running a cleaning plant or any other thing. And I think as we move ahead and as those areas, the business area, gets more recognition and more credibility, then I think more young people will go into it. Unfortunately, in the white corporate world as we know it today, there is a ceiling on how far blacks can go. There are rare exceptions, but by and large, the vice presidency is as far as you can go. Now, there are some of us who are not just temperamentally suited to be only vice president. We want to be presidents. We want to run things. We want to be in charge. For those people, I say, you've got to go out and start your own. And so I believe for people who are satisfied to be a vice president, perhaps in the long run, for people who want to work for someone else and to live under the fear now of mergers and buyouts, all of which jeopardize their security, if they want to live that way, fine. But if they really want to have a degree of security, a degree of fulfillment, if they want to make a contribution to the race as a whole, then I think they need to go out and start their own.
If you had to do it all over again today, what type of business would you go into?
If I was starting over again today, and if all the publications were in place that are in place today, I don't think I'd go into the publishing business. I think I'd be inclined to go into the service business, somewhere where you're rendering service. I might want to start my own chain of hamburger places. I still think it's very sad that we don't have barbecue franchises. I think we could develop cleaning establishment franchises. I think anything that would give service to the public would be a good thing to go into now. Because service is no longer important to people. You walk around and people are arrogant. They're insensitive. They don't want to serve. So I'd want to be in something where service would move me ahead.
What advice would you give a small business going after a larger client?
And I developed a simple philosophy. I said that I would call companies and they all wanted to refer me to the contributions department. And I say, no, I don't want a contribution. I want to give you something in return for your giving me something. I would always say that if the president of the smallest country in the world came to America, our president, as a matter of public policy and protocol, would see that president. And I said to the people, I am the president of a very small company, but I am the president. And I feel that as a matter of courtesy, your president ought to see me. Now, I have to say I was never turned down. I was put aside, I was delayed, but I was never turned down. And persistence went out. I think what you need more than anything else in going into business is persistence, a refusal to give up, a motivation to continue when everything looks like you ought to quit. And I think that's what entrepreneurs have to have.
How important is access to information to the small business person?
There's a great need for information. There are all kinds of people out there who are writing me letters and calling up with good ideas and wanting to know how to go into business. So I think if we had a national television show devoted to business development, it would be a great thing.
Thousands of jobs for local people by Chinese investor shoe factory, Huajian Shoe Factory in Ethiopia. Since formal diplomatic ties forged between China and Ethiopia more than four decades ago, the overall relationship and cooperation between the two countries have grown steadily. Ethiopia has taken China as an example for its economic growth and development. In recent years, the partnership and economic cooperation between the two countries have brought about fruitful outcomes in different sectors, particularly in infrastructure and industrial parks development. The Eastern Industry Zone in the town of Dukem, Oromia Regional Estate, just 35 kilometers south of the capital Addis Ababa, is one of the mega projects carried out with the Chinese investment in the development of manufacturing sector in Ethiopia. The once farming town began to see a surge in manufacturing in 2010 when Ethiopia's first industrial park was opened here. The Eastern Industry Zone has housed about 85 factories with the Chinese investments and a shoe factory in the industry zone, that is, Huajian Shoe Factory, has enabled the country to bear fame on the world exporter map for its Made in Ethiopia shoes. I'm on the premises of the Eastern Industry Zone in Dukem Town, 35 kilometers south of Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. This is the gate of Huajian Shoe Factory. Built with Chinese investment, the 40-hectare Eastern Industrial Zone is where Huajian, a Chinese shoemaker producing for brands like Guess, Calvin Klein, Nina and other branded items, set up its factory in 2011. Huajian Shoe Factory, as the Eastern Industry Zone alone, has created job opportunities for about 2,500 local Ethiopians. This was followed by a second Hojay factory in August 2016 in the firm's own industrial park on the outskirts of the capital, Addis Ababa. You can see the picture of the new Hojin International Light Industry Zone being under construction in Addis Ababa. The Ethiopia-China Hojin International Light Industry City, invested and constructed by Hojin Group, is located in the Labu Lasto district of Addis Ababa, capital of Ethiopia. The functions include such as export processing, trade and service, among others. This integrated industrial park focuses on a light industry, and its theme is science and technology, high efficiency, civilization, harmony, and environmental friendly. It is a leading area and a demonstration area among the African industrial parks of China's advanced and advantageous industry developing in Africa through One Belt, One Road strategy. The Hojin Light Industry City, projected with a total investment of $1 billion, covering a total area of 137.8.
All right. We were supposed to talk about intentional communities today, which is what we're going to convert our project here in Florida into, but and I thought I loaded it up last night when I got near program time. I hadn't loaded anything up. I had loaded it up on a another platform, which isn't Blog Talk. So I put trending topics in for today. So But I guess the trending topics for this week, because it's Wednesday, middle of the month, the 17th of the month, November 2021, will be the Ahmaud Arbery trial and the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. So we're going to take this quick little break and come back and trending topics, starting off with those two trials, or if you guys want to talk about something else, we can talk about something else. But while it's on my mind, not trending topics, intentional communities, we will, if we don't touch on it tomorrow, Thursday, we'll touch on it for sure Friday. And then I think we have a clubhouse. We got a clubhouse day at 6 o'clock. I think we'll probably cover, not trending topics, what do you call it, the intentional communities on that. And I'll explain why we're going with intentional communities. But if you want to talk about it today, fine. But we're coming back with at least two. I'm sure there are many trending topics. Just the two that I'm hearing the most about is the Rittenhouse case and the Arbery case. Particularly with the some commentator on YouTube, and brought up a very good headline on, I mean, will these two trials, I mean, because we don't know the verdict yet, okay, in either one of these cases. The Rittenhouse case is now in jury deliberations, but the possibility is there are, I mean, if you racialize things, which we do here in the United States, if all four white males, the three in the Arbery case, and there's one in the, Kyle Rittenhouse case, if they're all acquitted, the question is, can white men in the United States be judge, jury, and executioner? I guess that's the question of the day. We'll be back in a few minutes. Another day, a trending topic question of the day, and I'll repeat it, in light of the Ahmaud Arbery trial, where three men are on trial, I don't know, you know what, there's one guy, Roddy, or whatever Roddy's name is. matter of fact, Robin, no, it's too late to bring up the audio. But one of the lawyers, I think it's for the Roddy guy, and this is an Ahmaud Arbery trial, he has objected or attempted to object, request of the judge. He's been turned down twice, to my knowledge. When Al Sharpton was in the courtroom, and it's a public place, he requested that Al Sharpton, correct me if I'm wrong, somebody, be, you know, removed from the courtroom, and then Jesse Jackson, either was it yesterday or the day before, this week, he was in the courtroom the next day, and this lawyer for one of the defendants wanted him removed from the courtroom, not courthouse, but from the courtroom as well. You know, and I was thinking with that request, I was thinking, you know what, if this was during the Emmett Till era, that request might have been granted. But that's just me thinking out loud. Anyway, the question, before I get to the question today, the trending topic question today. Now, going to the, now that was the Ahmaud Arbery trial, okay. So, with the Kyle Rittenhouse case, Kyle Rittenhouse was allowed to, by lottery system, which apparently, according to the judge in that case, they've been doing it for at least 20 years. The defendant, by lottery, you know, picking, you know, one of those little tumbler things or whatever, you know, he's allowed to pick out some alternate jurors. But according to the judge system in that town, they're allowed, that's tradition. It's customary. Okay. So it might be new to us, but there, and there are probably some other places like that, I don't know. So now, with that in mind, the question today is, and now that this is if, because we don't know, no verdict has come back on the Kyle Rittenhouse case. That's just, they're deliberating on it right now. And I think he's got, 12 charges? No, they dismissed one. So he's got at least 10 or 11 that they're deliberating on. But if he's acquitted out of all those charges and his self-defense works, and he's acquitted to all of them. Oh, you know, while it's on top of my mind, you know, now, Kyle Rittenhouse, 17 years old at the time, he's 18 years now. You know, it's a very high profile case, and it's a high profile case for him, a young white male. But I'm just throwing this out there. How many other Kyle Rittenhouses were roaming the street that night in the same vicinity, maybe even a few feet away, also armed, but the only distinction is the other people didn't kill anybody. In any event, the trending topic question of the day is, now, this is a hypothetical. Let's say Kyle Rittenhouse gets acquitted of all charges up in Wisconsin, and the three white males in, I think it was, what, South Carolina? Or Georgia? I don't know, it's Georgia. They get acquitted of 100% of all their charges. The question will that send a signal? Oh no, hold on, that might not be the word, might royal signal. If all four guys are acquitted, will that be a reflection? Oh, maybe reflection is not the right word. I'm trying to, you guys can help me out. Will that say that in the United States, that it's all right for a white male to be judge, jury, and executioner? I mean, you know, we really need to flip that around. Is it all right? Now, if all four of them get acquitted, which I doubt, if all four got acquitted, would that say that in the United States of America, that it's all right? Now, I'm switching the order of things around on this now. Same words, but the order around. Is it all right for a white male to be the executioner, number one? Number two, also be the judge and also be the jury. Because that's how things really happen. They weren't judge, jury, and executioner. No, they were executioners first. Well, hold it. Then again, were they judges? Or hold it. Well, let's turn this around. Were they actually executioners first, or were they the judges first, then the executioner, and then the jury? I'll leave that up to you. But, you know, that's if all four get acquitted of all charges. I don't think that's going to happen. Here's what I think is going to happen. Just my two cents. In the South Carolina trial, the guy Roddy, with the lawyer that doesn't want Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton in the courtroom, I think he'll probably get, if he gets convicted, he'll get the lighter sentence. I think he'll get the lighter sentence. The father and son, I think the son will probably get the most. I think the son will get convicted. I think the father will be convicted. But I think the person who's going to get the most time will be the son who was in, you know, wrestling with the gun with Aubrey. So I think the son will get the most time. I think the father will get convicted. We're going overtime, folks, so forget about the 90 seconds and 60 seconds and 10 seconds. I think the father will also be convicted. I don't know about Roddy guy who was in the pickup. I think if anybody in that case has got a ghost of a chance of getting off all charges would be him. But it's a very high profile case. He's in the mix. So, but out of the three, I think he'll get off the lightest and the son I think he'll get the most time out of that. I'm just theorizing at this point because I'm those two, the father and son, they were out going to make a citizen's arrest. All right, so that might be common in that neck of the woods. I don't know. Now, with the Kyle Rittenhouse case, like I just mentioned earlier, there were a lot of Kyle, in my opinion, because I wasn't up there. In my opinion, there were a lot of Kyle Rittenhouse, well, maybe a lot's not the right word. I'm theorizing that there were probably some other Kyle Rittenhouses that lived in Kenosha or came to Kenosha with the intent of helping out, okay? They were also armed like Rittenhouse. Once again, I'm theorizing here. I wasn't there, okay? But I believe there were others. However, the only reason why we know of Rittenhouse's name is because he killed two people and severely injured another one. All right, so, and, you know, there's no black and white issue now. Not in the Rittenhouse case. It's one white male killing two other white males and injuring another white male. All right? But you got, I mean, publicly, and Rittenhouse had a $2 million bond over his head. They went online, and $2 million is a lot of money to raise, particularly from strangers. But the money was raised, and he made bail. Okay, so there's a lot of people that, and it's a polarizing case up in Wisconsin. Some people think that Rittenhouse is a hero because one of the people that he shot dead, allegedly, I don't know all the backstory on it, had a record as a pedophile. The thing is, when Rittenhouse shot him, Rittenhouse didn't know any of this guy. He didn't know the background of none of these people that he shot. Okay. Rittenhouse's defense was, it was either me or them, self-defense. Whether it'll work or not, I don't know. But what the DA's office has done in Wisconsin, is they threw some spaghetti up on the wall, and that's the number of charges. The judge has already dismissed one, but I believe, and I'm just theorizing here, one of those charges, if he's got 10 more charges left, I believe one of those charges will stick. The one that sticks out in my mind is reckless endangerment, which caused a homicide. I believe he's going to get stuck with at least one. At least one. Okay. We'll have to bring Warren Houston on here maybe tomorrow to go in a lot more detail. Because that's his lane. All right. So, anyway, but trending topic because this is a big if. If all white males, all four white males are acquitted of these homicides, will that say that white men can be, in this country, be executioner, judge, and jury? 314, your mic is open.
You know, I was looking at some land out there in Cochise County, Arizona.
Arizona, okay. It's cheap out there.
And I seen a ranch. Oh, I guess it's a ranch.
How many?
80-stall horse ranch.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I forget how many horses is being stored there. But I don't know what I would do with that. I'd have to move out to Arizona. I don't want to move to Arizona.
Man, I don't know nothing about horse ranches. They've got some here in Florida, but I don't know nothing about horses. Other than I imagine they eat pretty well and their food bill is not cheap.
Then they had some more plots out there.
Yeah, you're going to need a vet, somebody that knows how to, you know, look after those horses. You know, if they get whatever horses come down with, their injuries or sick, whatever. But they're a beautiful animal. But, man, that's enough for me just to keep up with a dog or a cat.
Well, it seems to me like that place was used for people to board their horses there to be taken care of. It has a large reception area, dining room, and so on and so on.
That sounds it sounds like it's already in operation, so it sounds like...
Oh, yeah, they said it was some horses there. It was being boarded. I forget how many.
Yeah, you had to ask. Anybody that gets involved in something like that, they know something about horses or have a partner that knows something how to run that operation.
Then there was some lots for sale. There's only like one half, about 3,000 feet from electricity. I bet that would cost a lot to bring electric to that place, just for one.
Yeah, it usually does. That's why, I don't know if we're going to do it tomorrow, but within the next 5 days, next week or so, we're going to talk about intentional communities because in some of these places, like the county that you named in Arizona, they got counties like this all over the United States. When you buy a patch of land, it'll be good to know what you're going to use that land for. So in some cases, your best bet might, now if you're already with a group of people, is to organize an intentional community. And different communities have different intentions. Some people want to grow food. Some people want to live outside the city. It might be a group of people, like with the horse ranch that you just mentioned. That's more like maybe a business owner or two or three. You know, they might want to get together, and that's something that they might be looking for. But I imagine if it's a horse ranch, it's got a few acres to it.
Yeah, the land looks real nice.
You know how many acres? It's got to be probably over 10 acres, isn't it?
Yeah, I forgot what I read. And I would pull. It was on eBay. I followed your advice and went to eBay to see what was going on. There wasn't too many things that was there attractive. They had some places down in Mississippi I wouldn't live in. One had an old house on, looked like it comes back out of the 1800s.
There's a lot out there for sale. You know, a lot of it could be bought on the cheap, but we bought it up yesterday. I mean, just because it's cheap,
it's
not going to cost
$500. $500, and you got some for. I seen some up around $200,000.
It can get up.
But
they even have, I haven't checked it in a while, but I imagine they still do it. Occasionally you might find a town for sale on eBay.
Yeah. That'd be good for Robin. She could be the mayor of the damn town.
Well,
be the mayor, Robin's the judge, and the executioner.
Now let's go, Robin, Robin, she's got her phones there. Robin, chime in if you buy your phone. But yeah, now so I don't think in both of those cases, I don't think all four guys will get off scot free, and it's a possibility, but I don't think it. But now, what's your take? Let's start with the Rittenhouse case.
Kyle Rittenhouse is not guilty of no things. And what's at issue here is, do people have the ability to use deadly force as an excuse when they, fear of life and deadly force, which they do. Rittenhouse didn't do anything wrong. And people need to stop that. The thing that's so trifling with black people. I had a conversation with, showed some examples with you.
Mm-hmm.
And black folks is some of the most racist people, just like anybody else.
I agree.
But it's always pretended and given as if they not.
You have some people, mostly black people, that say, I don't agree with them, that a black person can't be racist. But I disagree with that.
Yeah, and then they come up with these damn excuses just because they came up through life, made some bad choices, and as it look now, here they are becoming middle age and haven't made the progress that they see that others are making. Maybe that's not the reason. Then they come up with all these damn excuses saying what somebody, whites, have done to keep them from advancing. Well, hell, what about the ones that did advance? Well, then they come up with another excuse. Well, they're going to let a few go through. Well, hell, you should have been up early in the morning so you can get in the head of the line so you could have been one of the few that got through.
Well, you got 20-year-olds that make up some of those excuses, too.
And you know,
but
another thing, you had one person on talking about people rather than working for somebody that you need to have your own business. Then he gave the example of having a McDonald's. Now, you remember that one? And also he gave the example of the guy who's an electrician. So it had, that was early on. It was on Naima. So, okay. Now, let me ask you something. If you got a McDonald's, who going to work for you?
There's a lot of people that will work for you if you own a McDonald's. Yeah.
Well, why you want them to work? Why don't you want them to go out and get their own McDonald's so they can compete against you?
Was that on? I only listened to about 10 minutes of Naima's show today.
No, that was on your show. Why don't they encourage, rather than you hiring these people to work for you, everybody that come there for a job, tell them that they should start their own McDonald's?
You know,
instead
that's not
of
gonna
you,
work.
Instead of you using the analogy that rather than going to college, getting a degree, and taking on debt, why don't you start your own business? Then he said, made mention of him starting a McDonald's. Well, hell, if you start a McDonald's, you got to have somebody doing what? Working for you.
Working.
If you're
going
to have a plumbing company, you're going to have somebody doing what?
Working.
Working for you.
Yeah.
Well, rather than when those plumbers come there to work with you, why don't you encourage them to start their own plumbing business so you have every plumber standing on every corner?
That ain't going to work, Bianchi.
Well, then why do people fall for that old story?
Yeah, a lot of people.
Why do people fall for that story, though, L.A.?
All people are different. You said more than I do. Everybody.
If you got 40 million blacks in the country,
right,
and take out half of them, 20 million. So 20 million of them are going to start their own business doing barbershop, selling knickknacks, doing restaurants, doing stores, growing gardens. Is that what's going to happen? Then who's going to work for you?
Maybe you know the statistic, and somebody out there listening might know it. What percentage of black folks do own businesses? Let's just start with
that. I can give you a rough estimate.
Okay.
Black's business at one point was like 1.8 million, I think, in one U.S. Census business survey. A business survey is when forms go out to businesses and they fill them in and send them back in the U.S. Census. Blacks had close to 2 million businesses. All right. But guess how many people
now.
They had working?
Now, with that had, 2 million, now, were most of those sole proprietorships? Because I don't count a sole proprietorship as a real business.
Well, here's the thing, L.A. They had like 1.9, 1.8 million businesses.
Okay,
and they hired less
about
than
40
million
people. Okay.
They hired less than a million people.
Mm-hmm.
How do you have twice as many businesses than you do employees?
Well, I haven't looked at those stats, but from some old stats I do remember, and I don't remember the number, a lot of those businesses were sole proprietorships. So let's say a sole proprietorship that's a drywall business. If you don't show up for the job or you get sick, you're basically the drywall business. So I consider a business when you've got employees or subcontractors and you physically don't have to show up to have the job done. I consider that a real business.
Well, what I'm saying is, and I'll tell you here in a minute exactly what the number is, but what I'm saying is that what you got is a lot of people, and it's okay if that's what they want to do. You can't tell people how to live their life, but
right.
I'm just talking about the information, is that they got a lot of businesses that don't hire no people. And one would have to ask the
well,
question.
Well, if you
now,
only got one person, if you got a one-man operation, which many people do, and you don't, is not enough revenue coming in where you can hire other people.
And that's the point. You don't have enough revenue to
if
hire.
Have, I know a guy who's a painter, does good work, but he's self-employed, but he's only got an. The way he does his business is just, in the way that he structures the job, is basically just enough revenue for himself. You know, there's a lot of landscapers. You know, that's they're self-employed. Now, if business picks up, you know, then they might have enough revenue to pay for another person. But a lot of
all right,
so
here's this information here. Let me see. Let me go to this year. I keep these information. They had the number of firms, 2.593 million. It's what blacks had. Number of paid employees, 110,786. Number of firm with paid employees, I'm sorry. Number of paid employees for pay period, 1,046,000. The average income per firm, $72,359.49. Now, here you got, of all firms, you got 2.5 million firms. And the number of paid employees per pay period is 1,045,120. Now let's look at the black female. Black female has 1.5 million firms. And they had 332,000 paid employees. Their average income was $28,860.39.
And a big majority of those were probably hairstylists.
The black male is 133,015, and he had 615,468 paid employees with 1,017,953 businesses. Now let's go look at the
A lot of them are barbers.
Asians. Asians have 1.9 million firms. Blacks have 2.5 million firms. To be exact, at this report, 2,593,168 for the blacks, 1,937,368 for the Asians. Blacks had number of paid employees for a pay period, 1,045,120. Asians, 3,839,292. The revenue for the blacks, 72,358.49. The revenue for the Asians, $409,602.93. The revenue for the black female business, $28,860.39. The revenue for the Asian female business, $216,595.09. See the difference?
Mm-hmm.
Check this out, though. The revenue for the white female, $192,784.18. I mentioned again, the revenue for the Asian female, $216,595.09. Asians outdoing white women, the Asian woman. Now, of course, they're not going to outdo the white male when you're talking about close to $1 billion.
Well, we got to look at what businesses that they're in. I mean, I'm sure that's a factor. With just on a surface level, I'm sure black women that are entrepreneurs, they have a hair salon. They do hair.
I don't know what they're doing. That's a lot of damn
hair
places.
Huh?
That's a lot of hair places, but you can find out if you really wanted to. Let me give you another stat here. The Hawaiian Pacific female, check this out. She got $25,165 firms. The black female's got 1,526,699 firms. The black female's gross is $28,860.39. The Asian female gross, the native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islanders female-owned building gross, $77,405.56. She's grossing three times as much as the black female with only 26,000. 165 firms compared to the black female, 1,526,699 firms. That's the kind of data I like to look at. Don't you?
Yeah. I'm into statistics.
Let's go to the Hispanic.
Wait a minute. Robin's popped up with something.
Hang on, let me do this real quick. Let's go to the Hispanic female.
All right.
She's got 9,932,434 businesses. The black American has got 1,526,699. Of course, we told you the black American grossed $28,800.39. The Latino female grows $162,731.40. The male for the Latino grows $756,299.32. The black male grows $133,035.52.
I know in the DMV, the DC area, Latino, well, let me break it down. Latino women. Latino women have almost, well, they got a significant niche carved out when it comes to housekeeping. They got their own cars and all that. But you also have some Ethiopian women that are doing a pretty good job.
What
but they
talking
own the hotel.
About
then?
And the then, black, the female, the, mm-hmm. look at this. Latino female has, with her 9.9 million firm, she hired 8,982,588 employees. The black female only hired 332,264.
Latino women hire their own. And they're more visible. I see more of them.
How is it that the Latino, how is it that the Latino in today's times, these people come here damn near poor rich, poor broke, and they have this much more income, business income, than black females?
Well, Robin, you there, Robin? Never liked them.
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, any comment?
He said, how is it that they have more income?
Business income, quadruple than the black female. Even guess who? American Indian and Alaska Native. Their female-owned business grows $71,456.85, and the black female grows $28,800.39.
They don't work as many hours as Robin does.
Why is it that black Americans own damn near every data point is last?
Good reason. This is a good example why people need to start their own businesses. I heard you say earlier, you know, instead of teach our children to start a business. Okay.
Yeah, well, here's the thing, Robin. Look at the black female when it comes to hiring people. Hell, they ain't hiring nobody, Harley. The black female, she hires 332,264. The Hispanic female hires 8,982,588.
Off the top of my head, I would say, culturally speaking, you know, Latinos hire within the family first.
Well, shouldn't blacks, people say blacks need to stick together. Then when I ask them, are you just talking, he said, no, we're talking about all blacks. The Asian female hires 863,353 employees, and her income is $216,595.09 on average of all the business, compared to the black female business is $28,860. What's going on here?
No, I don't, like I say, I don't, they don't work as hard as Robin does. Robin's
maybe
up.
They're just not in the right thing.
Robin's up at 3:30, 4:30 in the morning.
I don't have a job. I'm a business owner, and I'm drawing a pension too, but I'm a business owner, okay? And so being a business owner, it could be limitless, the income that I generate. And then I'm not dependent upon someone to pay me. It's off of my efforts that I put in and the marketing. And I'm teaching my children and my grandchildren start a business. My granddaughter's 8 years old. She came up the other day. She says, Grandma, I need you to help me make some books. And she took some pieces of paper and glued and stapled them together. And then she made a little booklet. And then she wrote a story in the book, and then she made another one and made another story, and then she goes, I want to go on YouTube and show other people how to do this. I go, well, you know, that could be a business. And so now I have her brain thinking, and now I'm going to get her into by making that into a business. I sure am. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, here's the thing. The median income for blacks is about $33,000. What is it, $35,000? L.A.?
No, I haven't looked at the stat.
About $35,000. Well, hell, this business is only grossing $28,000. So where is the, how are they living? How is the female living, this black female? And the business itself is only grossing $28,000.
Don't know.
Medium income is about $35,000. Hell, he might as well go to work for somebody. Now, I'm just saying, based on the numbers I'm seeing, I don't know the circumstances, but I like to look at data. Data tells you a whole lot. It tells you the areas where you need to have improvement, either personally, your company, or a whole daggone town.
Now, I imagine statistically, because a good portion of black folks in the United States live in the South. So we're talking about places like North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and parts of a lot of West Florida.
L.A., that ain't no excuse new because they break it down to
no,
you what
no,
black
but they,
businesses
they make
are.
Less money in those places.
Yeah, but most of black business is up north, not down south. I hear what you're saying, and I know people start reaching. Oh, heck, I got a later one than this. I know people start reaching, and when they hear these things, and it's still the same thing, unless I didn't. This is 2016, $28,860. I mean, it's still the same thing. The majority of black businesses is up north, not down south.
Okay.
In your big cities, Chicago, Atlanta.
Yeah, in Chicago, yeah, the cost of living's more and the people earn more in Chicago versus Columbia, South
Carolina. Yeah, but
Carolina.
That has nothing to do with if people earn more, that means that the businesses should be earning more because they're selling based on what the market would stand. So it depends on what you're selling. Now, if you're selling something that nobody wants, don't nobody want with no great demand, then quite naturally you're not going to make a lot of money off of it.
Well,
you know, a person that's in a car dealership.
On an optic level, just on an optic level, a very surface optic level, hair salons. You got a lot of black women who want hair, beauty salons, hair salons, whatever you want to call them. But there's a glut of them. You can be on one block, and there's two, three.
Is that all
blocks.
They know what to do?
No.
Why don't they
but
go to college and get
it?
Why don't they go to college and learn
into.
Something? Yeah, but why don't they go
well,
to college and learn something?
I can't. I'm not going to do it. I don't know all that. I'm just saying, with a hair salon, a lot of people who go to beauty school, both male and female, okay, typically, at least the ones that I've run across, they've tried other things, and this is the last
well,
thing that they can probably get some family support on. Either you make beauty
hair.
School
well,
work,
how do you make money?
It.
How do you make money as a black barber and most of your males running or wear dreads?
Look, well, this is what I said I got from Dudley.
Huh?
When it comes to hair, and Robin knows because she's a female, 75% of the people who pay to get their hair done don't have it done in a hair salon anyway.
They and they don't have it done with black
home.
Because many of them don't do extensions. I thought it was the Africans that were doing the braiding and so forth.
Well, I guess they – Robin, that's your department.
Well, let's look at what is the black male's businesses. Now, you know they do break it down in
we do barbershops,
business categories.
We do landscaping.
Well, they ain't doing landscaping down here in the South, out in Louisiana. These Mexicans are
well,
doing
that. Well, yeah, you're right. Because in certain places, Latinos got a lockdown.
They got a lockdown on it. Now, they do break it down in business categories where blacks are at. You know, they even have mining, timber. Of course, there ain't much of nobody in that. Fisheries and so on. They break it down. And I just don't have that right here in front of me. But I know one thing. When it comes to jobs, they are overrepresented. And when I say overrepresented, based on their numbers in the population, which is what, 11%, 13%, whatever, they are overrepresented in the service industries. And it just so happened on your skit, on your one of your videos, that's what the man says. I'm going to start a business. I start a service industry. Then he went on to talking about McDonald's. So the
right.
service industry with your home care, health care, and other
and when
industries
it comes to
like
home
that.
Care or health care, matter of fact, one of my mother's nurses before she passed, she said overwhelmingly, if you're going to see a black person in that business, it will be a black female. She said it's rare that you see a black male in home care, home health care.
Well, that's where a lot of them, like 24% of those that's got jobs, they find them in those
mm-hmm.
fields there. Engineering, around 4%.
You don't
medical,
see that many black engineers.
Medical professions is less than that. Construction.
Well, as you've stated several times, we need, it's so much. I don't know, is it enough of us to go through everything now? You know, 13% is not a whole lot of people.
No, it's not. But you should at least be in something representative of your numbers in the population. And I'm saying that if you did last in everything, seemingly, not everybody seemingly. See, I like to qualify for why I just make blanket statements that the
mm-hmm.
us and the we and the days. But should not you be targeting maybe some particular industry that pays a lot of money? Isn't that what we see immigrants do? It's like them African immigrants.
Boy,
they overrepresented in engineering and medicine.
Well, we're lopsided. This is in my opinion. We're lopsided when it comes to sports. A lot of people, when they think about a particular, well, I hate to say it, black folk, when it comes to making a lot of money,
entertainment.
Typically, the thing that comes up is NBA or NFL.
Well, entertainment,
you don't hear nobody
period,
talking
right?
about nothing in the STEM professions, like or even what you did. You don't hear those things pop out of people's heads. I mean, mouths.
Yeah. Well, look,
like for instance, if
what.
If I was a high schooler again, I'd rather pick the line of work that you went into versus playing sports.
Well, you know, you can play sports.
I would have been made fun of. I'm talking about it as a career thing.
Yeah, I trained my grandson in baseball and also made
right,
him do
you know,
his academics.
It's one thing playing baseball, but you know what? I'd rather build the stadium.
Well,
give me the stadium or the arena.
Well, that's that too, but you need if you're going to run those things, you got to work for somebody and know what you're doing. But the thing
nothing,
is,
okay, nothing wrong with that.
Only,
you got to learn a trade. You have to learn a trade.
Say
you got to get your
credit. What he's done, what I've done, because I think I knew better. I say, you're going to do this. And you're going to do that. And he's double majored.
Mm-hmm.
He's got one more semester in his second major.
Now,
which is
Bianchi, you also know that there are a lot of parents that steer their sons and daughters into the military.
Well, yeah, they
but
do.
You can, if you go in the military, there's still hope. But you
yeah,
know,
they give you... The Navy used to give you a damn good education, but they started to cut that off because the grade of people that they had to – people couldn't come in – they couldn't be recruited.
Mm-hmm.
Then what they done, they tried to put the ROTC pre-recruitment into the high schools.
Right, they did.
In order to try to help prep these kids for what they're going to see if they
you
do
know,
are
when
admitted
I was
into
in
the
school
service.
System – When I was in school, they had ROTC at our school, but you had some kids which were, I guess, misguided at the time because they were all into the ROTC class, but they would
mm-hmm.
neglect studying for the other classes, the other academics.
That's a problem also. I've seen all kind of schemes going back to the 70s with black studies. And see, here's another thing. You know, you're talking about, Kyle, why in the heck is so much concern with blacks on Kyle Rittenhouse? Like you mentioned, he shot, it's confusing. He shot
all
white
folks.
Yeah. So why is black so, have so much animosity on Kyle Rittenhouse?
You know what I think? Now I'm just theorizing because what was that case with the black dude, Blake?
Yeah.
You know, I think that I'm just theorizing.
Kyle didn't have nothing to do with that.
I know that, but you know, Priyanka, you know that most of these cases end up all emotional with little or no facts.
All over the place. All over the place.
All emotional.
I even heard a show where they talking about yet another black organization talking about coming together. I said, I ain't never heard of this organization. I thought I heard about all of them. And, you know, here's another thing about the judge when he made mention about Asian food, and then they immediately jump on and say he's making fun of Chinese.
And they racialize that, too.
But wait a minute. Asia has about 100 different countries, from India all the way over to Britain and France.
You know what? You're
now,
absolutely
course,
right.
They say
you got
Britain
Saudi
and France
Arabia,
is Europe.
Qatar, you got Kyrgyzstan, that's Central Asia, India, Pakistan,
Russia, all that.
Most of Russia is in Asia. You're right. Thailand.
Yeah,
Cambodia.
But you got some faction out there want to say Russia is Europe. That's some dumbasses. But what I'm saying is what you said. Look at all the different foods that's coming out of Asian country, and then these news reporters. These ratchet news reporters, these slimy news reporters, especially a lot of the females that you hear today, they going to jump on the Chinese man. He's making fun of, he's
you
a
know what,
I'm going
to see if he's available. The guy I had on yesterday, where I call him Mr. Sick, I might see if he can come on tomorrow or the next day. He's a black dude, black American, but he speaks Russian fluently. Spanish. He lived in Russia for quite a bit of time, and he spent quite a bit of time in the Asian part of Russia. So he's a
you
rare,
know that
but,
one Russian town over there voted a black Zambian
black mayor
as mayor.
Yep, I remember that.
I don't know if you feel it.
And he's
I
only
know,
black
listen,
one in town.
I know some Zambians that live in Russia because we were doing a communication deal.
Yeah, well, you find
no, Poland. I'm sorry. He lived in Poland. Richard stays in Poland.
You find practically every place you go, you can find an African person. We need to go because it's 12 after 1, and I don't want Blog Talk to drop us.
All right, well, you know, hey, another thing, you should look at Calvin Mackey as a motivation and get rid of some of those ones you got on the early, especially that Chinese one.
I'm going to go on YouTube right now and look him up. All right, thank you.
He's in New Orleans. I'll talk to you later.
Okay.